Hello and welcome to Free Speech with CR. I'm Molly Blakemore, and I'm here with my co-host, Dr. Keith Blamer,
President
of College of the Redwoods.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure being here today. And I would like to have our guest introduce themselves, please. John Villanueva-Fort.
Sure. I'm John Johnston. I teach philosophy here at CR. I've been here for 23 years, originally came as an English professor, and then moved over to philosophy some number of years ago.
Wonderful.
And we're lucky to have you, John. And I'm Natalia Margulies, and I can't believe time flies. This is my 10th year at CR. Originally, I am from the East Coast, and I'm finding myself more and more of a West Coaster and almost a humbled native.
Almost a humbled native?
Yeah.
So originally, you're from the Soviet Union.
Originally, I'm from...
Oh, sorry.
And you're from where? Where'd you get John up about that door there?
Well, originally, I was born in Moscow, and essentially quite a story for another time. But I came here as a teenager. I came to the United States without my family. And being from a pretty sheltered background, it was quite a shocker. Let's just say I expected like a Hollywood welcome.
Mm.
But yeah,
close.
But you landed in New York. But I landed in Virginia. Yeah. And later New York. And then LA, and now I'm in Humboldt. So.
Well, it's thank you both for agreeing to come in and talk to us today.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. Let me just lay the groundwork for why we're here today. The conversation about free speech and the conversation that surrounds academic freedom in this country has been under attack by several states and as well as the Trump administration. And we have been awfully careful about how we maneuver through the challenges that we're seeing. And I have been on record to say that the administration will protect academic freedom at all costs, that's the hill that I'm willing to die on. And so that is why we're here. We want to have an honest conversation about academic freedom, what it is, what it is not, some of the concerns that faculty have in the classroom. And so I'd like to start that conversation off and forget. So I wonder, John, can you talk to us about what is actually academic freedom and how does it differ from free speech?
Okay, that's a big question. That's a good one. So academic freedom as a concept is usually broken into three areas. So area number one would be the freedom of professors to research and publish. And the second area would be the freedom to speak on their subjects in the classrooms. And then the third area is a little broader, which is the freedom to speak on matters of public interest, matters of institutional interest, and later that becomes to speak in forms of shared governance. As a concept, just broadly speaking, academic freedom has been around since at least the 13th century. The folks in the monasteries would talk about the importance of being able to be free in their theological pursuit. So the idea of being a free inquiry has been around in intellectual circles for quite a bit. It gets kind of its first formal articulation by the philosopher Immanuel Kant in the very late 18th century.
I had to read Kant.
Okay. Yeah. He's
okay,
a big,
I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. And he wrote a paper, I think it was called Conflicts Among the Faculties. I think that was what it was. And he argued that we could break up the faculty and the university into two broad categories, the higher and the lower. And the higher faculty were in law, medicine, and theology. And he argued that these people are servants of the public, and so they really have to be tightly bound in their inquiries and their pursuits. But those, what he called lower faculty, which included philosophy, art, music, math, that they needed to have the freedom to pursue their ideas and not have to be bound in by the same strictures as those higher faculty. Then in the late 19th century, as universities are really spreading across the country here in America, there starts to occur conflicts between members of the public, powerful members of the public, and universities. So they see professors coming out and they're speaking in favor of trade unions, or they're speaking in favor of a particular religious perspective, and this rubs people in the community, some of them in the community, the wrong way. They appeal immediately to the university president and say, I don't like what that person is saying. And then that person might be punished, might be terminated, might have the whole program demolished. And then in 1915, after a number of these events occur, the American Association of University Professors comes out in 1915 and they say, look, we need to embrace academic freedom in those three areas that I articulated initially. And they issued a formal paper. And this starts to spread. And then in 1940, it really starts to spread. They issue a sort of revised version of this statement called, it's called Statement on the Principle, or Statement of Principles on Academic Freedom and Tenure.
This, yes.
Okay. And this becomes a flashpoint, not just in America, but worldwide, because universities start to look at the statement of the importance of academic freedom and tenure, and they start to embrace it.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem was is that the most that could be done is to censure a university that they believed had violated these principles of academic freedom. It's not like it's a legally binding document. It's a set of principles that they've articulated that they think universities should adhere to. And if there is a charge that a university wasn't adhering to those principles, then they would do an investigation and they might put, you know, a university on the naughty list. But that doesn't have a lot of teeth to it. And so then to get teeth into the principles of academic freedom in the 1960s or so, individual faculty unions start to establish in their working contracts, either individually or collectively, their bargaining agreements, start to establish these principles of academic freedom. And then they become sort of contractually enforceable.
Yeah. So go ahead, Molly, this.
Well, I was just going to say, I was going to ask, so that's like an understanding of where it came from. But what are the practical implications of it in the classroom? Why is it important to have this academic freedom in the classroom?
Well, I mean, I was just going to add to what John was saying, because the initial question was the difference between academic freedom and freedom of speech. We asked that question. And, you know, it's hard to see in a nutshell because, of course, they kind of walk together and then they branch out. But if it were to be reductively formulated, I think, is the difference between the pursuit of knowledge and knowledge within the field, so within the guided parameters, pursuit of knowledge and truth, this would be academic freedom, right? Versus freedom of speech, it would be the ability to express your ideas and opinion no matter what, as long as this, you know, without persecution from the government.
So may I take that a little further then?
Yeah, please. Well,
so are you suggesting then that faculty, even though they have the academic freedom within the classroom, they don't actually have the freedom of speech within the classroom? Is that what you argue?
Whether they have a freedom of speech within the classroom, kind of, you know, and this is more of a legal distinction.
Yes.
Because I think the condition of time and place applies both to faculty and to students alike. So yes, the professor can set, it's like my turf, my classroom, right? They set these rules, and these rules align with the rules of the academic institution. But I believe, and this is an interesting question, that a professor may not express let's say hate speech within the classroom, but as a private citizen, they would be able to express it, let's say on X, formerly known as Twitter, as a private citizen, right? So this is the distinction I see. Does that answer your question?
Yes, sort of, which leads to other questions. John, were you about to add something to that?
Well, I think that the distinction between just freedom of speech and academic freedom within the confines of the classroom, the classroom is a particular environment where faculty are there to operate as professionals. And there are professional guidelines for our behavior. So like Natalia says, I can't go into a classroom and start engaging in harassing verbal behavior with students, because that's in conflict with the professional standards of teacher. And I wouldn't be able to claim that, well, I have the freedom of speech to call students whatever names I want to. That's my freedom of speech. And somebody said, well, no, there are ethical standards of behavior that you are obliged to adhere to when you're in that classroom with students. Where I think it gets a little trickier is when you have a faculty member who's in a classroom with students and they are bound by the standards of the discipline. They're so the professional standards of their subject. So I'm a science teacher, for example, and there's certain expectations of what the content is that's going to be taught in a particular science class.
And so this is a really good point because let's say as a science professor, I don't believe I have the academic freedom or logical freedom to come in and start talking about fairies in my class, right? This is because it is outside the bounds of dominant research within my discipline. Does that make sense?
But there's a fine line here, because one of the things that academic freedom is supposed to protect is the professor's ability to challenge disciplinary orthodoxies.
Exactly.
Right? So as Natalia says, yeah, I can't go into the science classroom and start teaching, here's why evolution isn't true. Oh, I could go in and teach, here are the arguments against evolution. But I would assume the assumption in the science classroom is we're going to operate off of these established scientific principles.
This is what I was trying to say, you know, and even though new ideas can be uncomfortable, new ideas about theories are not just uncomfortable in a science class. They are inappropriate because they exist outside all research and hegemonic discourse.
Right, but somebody might come forward at something, not the fairies, I don't think they'd come forward, but somebody might come, okay, so...
Like prove a fairy exists.
Well, they might come forward with a very revolutionary idea that perhaps reality isn't constituted only of physical material things, right? Not necessarily pointing at fairies, but maybe based on some research that they've done, they think they can make a compelling argument that there are limitations to science, let's say, for example.
I think this is well within the bounds of academic freedom.
Yeah, I think it is as well. And then the problem becomes, well, what happens when that faculty member's colleagues don't agree with these challenges to the established principles or orthodoxies of the discipline?
But that's because academic freedom is not absolute. It exists within the field of power within its own discipline. So, you know, within art history, there are some hegemonic discourses that place more emphasis on certain ideas over others, you know, and to stay on the right side of that, if you don't, I mean, you risk the wrath of your colleagues and the establishment.
No, it happens left and right. And also, isn't it true that you can't be teaching philosophy in a science class, or you shouldn't be? You should be bound by the subject matter that you were the expert on. So you're not going to take politics into a math class, or that's not protective.
Well, there's certain parties are better than others. Like,
but what if you can't do that, actually?
Because science is deeply philosophical at its core. You know, you can, of course, teach math and art together as well. These are fantastic interdisciplinary connections, but some of them are more logical than others, absolutely.
Well, I have heard, an example I've heard about where you think that there wouldn't be any justifiable crossover between politics and another discipline. I've had math faculty, in statistics in particular, talk about the pushback they would get from students when they would give them statistical problems to analyze that had to do with incarceration rates or some other political issue. And so, you know, are you going to make statistics meaningful? Well, if you want to, you're going to have it apply to the real world, and then instantly becomes political.
And then what's our stand?
What's our stand? In terms of...
Okay, for example, in our world today, we have parents, students, communities that are questioning what we're teaching in the classroom. And how much influence should that they actually have?
Can we flip it?
Oh, please.
I want to ask you,
yeah,
you know, as the administrator who I think... sort of at the end of the day answers for the health, well-being, and standing of the entire institution, you know, and shields the institution from the risks,
yes,
both internal and external. So I just wanted to flip it and see what they can do.
That is a great question, one that I actually think about every day because I know it's coming, and it has come a couple times to my desk, is I will always protect the faculty's right to teach their curriculum. And the outside world should not have any influence over that. Now, I would rely on the faculty union and the Senate to take a look at that and give advice on what the next step should be, right? Because I don't want CR to go the way of other schools like Harvard or Brown or Texas schools, to say that if someone lodges a complaint about a faculty member's teaching this and my kid doesn't like it, therefore the faculty should be fired. That has happened way too often in this country. That should never happen. And that will not happen today.
And what are the, I'm going to throw a very comfortable, what if hypothetical meant this. So in the vacuum,
yeah,
this is an honorable and just direction. But considering that today's influence is exerted not just, you know, by a single email or, you know, a few opinions expressed in private, everything happens extremely publicly.
It does, yeah.
Right? And that's the foremost challenge that we have to contend with, you know, as instructors as well. What if the pressure exerted on administration came in the form of threats, you know, a social media storm, TV cameras showing up in scores at our doorstep, you know, saying, they're not going to tell you change or else, but the pressure is going to be so public and so uncomfortable that some action might be necessitated. This is a hypothetical. We don't have to go there. But
no, actually, it's a great question because I think about this every time I turn on my computer, some email comes to me. And two things. One, we will always protect the freedom of the faculty and classroom. And we will always protect the freedom of every CR employee outside of the classroom. They have free speech rights, and no one should abridge those rights. And that's something that we will always stand on, even though it does get uncomfortable.
So you're saying it's a dichotomy sometimes if you're willing to navigate it?
We have been willing to navigate. Oh, this is not hypothetical. This is something that we have been doing.
I think at a higher level, it related to your original question. One of the things that I think would be foolish if we ignored this, and that is academic freedom is tremendous power.
Yes.
And, you know, with all things that have tremendous power comes tremendous responsibility. And when members of the...
Yeah, who's that in Spider-Man?
Right. Is that right?
Yeah, I do.
So...
Good one.
You asked or sort of set up this scenario where... You have members of the community who are complaining about what's being taught in a classroom.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And if academic freedom is abused, and I think it can be, and the public no longer, or some segment of the public no longer sees higher education as serving the common good, and they lose confidence in us as taxpayers, then we could be in real trouble. We have to have the confidence of the communities we serve, and that requires us to use our academic freedom responsibly and not to use it as an excuse for advancing, you know, a personal perspective or a personal political agenda. And I think that's, and if you look at studies over the last 5 or 6 years, there's been an increasing number of the population that is, in fact, I think I read it this morning, there was a Pew study that was done in, I think, 2019.
Actually, we used that, but yeah.
Okay. And it said it was like 32% of the population thought not that universities weren't serving the common good, but they were actually doing harm.
Yeah.
And that's that. If we ignore that problem, we're in serious trouble.
But the converse is also true, that if you cave to outside pressures within the classroom, you're going to lose a lot of respect and credibility at a professional level. So it is a fine line between, you know, balancing what the public wants and what you believe is your...
You know, I think about this question as I woke up in the 1960s in this country, that if I don't think that I would be sitting here if the universities kowtowed to the pressures of society.
You're referring to McCarthyism?
Yeah, absolutely. But also in anything in Jim Crow.
Jim Crow. Well, a bunch of faculty were fired during that time.
Exactly. And so where would we be if the universities didn't stand up and say, no more, we will teach what's best.
Mm-hmm.
right? And so there is a push-pull on freedom of speech and academic freedom.
There are some faculty, not here, at our institution that I'm aware of, but Judith Butler is a famous example, who have this perspective that faculty are, the term they use is uncommon beings.
Yes.
And their stance is that professors are put in a really unique role. It's not necessary. It's to advance the common good, but it's to advance the common good against the sentiments of common opinion or popular opinion.
Yes.
And that's positioning professors as kind of these institutionalized rebels of a sort, where the primary principles driving the profession are not necessarily the standards of the discipline, but of something like democracy or universal human rights, and that the higher education ultimately is serving those principles rather than the specific disciplinary requirements of their discipline.
Honestly, I agree with that sentiment. As that whole argument is faculty, and you're right, faculty are uniquely in a position to protect critical thinking and protect the background, the backbone of what democracy is.
And I think this gets back to the idea of freedom of speech and as opposed to freedom of academic freedom, in the sense that there are hierarchies of ideas within the classroom. Whereas in freedom of speech, everybody has the right to say whatever they want, regardless of whether that idea holds merit or it's quantifiably true. Yeah. Or
I can say whatever dumb things I want outside.
But you can't do that in the classroom. And in the classroom, you are able to say, no, that idea is not as good as this idea in when you're thinking about science, because traditional science is saying so.
That's a good point, Mo. I mean, I wish we had more time to talk about how this plays out in the arenas of like R1 research institutions versus community colleges, and also with the contemporary tendency to see our students more and more as our clients.
You know, why don't we take the time and explore that, Tyler?
We just had a 5-minute.
I know that we have the opportunity of going for an hour, I think, half now. Just speak if things are going well.
What specifically did you want to talk about here?
Let's explore it with you.
Well, you know, just talking about, I always ask to see the trail of money. You know, this is
always,
you know, this is kind of how the sausage is made, if you will. And it's also a question of what Harvard, Yale, Brown, as well as students are paying for, you know, versus what our community college students are paying for, you know? And so we can see the split, or at least I think there's a split between the sort of luxury, if you will, that R1 institution students have to attend in person and spend time with the interplay of ideas, almost like watching fireworks, you know, and having fun with it and taking their sweet time, versus a community college student who is strapped for cash, has a family at a time, you know, they're taking all these credits in the same time. They need this degree and they need it now, you know, in order to increase their earning potential for their survive. Right. So when we were talking earlier about challenging our students and at the same time serving our community, that's a tension as well, because a part of our community comes from more conservative backgrounds, you know, and what are they here for is a question in my mind, you know, if they're going to the police academy, for instance, you know, are they here? And I don't want to make any generalizations. It's a question, you know.
That's a good point.
Are they here to be challenged in their worldview? You know, or are they here to get skills and get out?
You know? So let me follow up there.
Yeah.
And I don't think this is what you're saying, but let me ask you.
Sure, sure.
Yes, sir. Are you saying then that we have to make a choice between satisfying what our community expects and giving what our and challenging our students' way of thinking? Right.
We need to drink a bar.
Oh, please, get the pause because then it's going to get to, in my mind, what the purpose of higher education
is. Yeah, we're getting into the weeds here, yes.
So actually, that's what we're here to do, is getting into the weeds. This is a big conversation.
Well, and I think of it in terms of, like, are you going for a certificate? Are you going for a skills building? Or are you going for the degree that will lead to a transfer? I mean, in that case, that's why we have you do all the other things that are more in line with the traditional idea of, you know, the university and the critical thinking and the exchange of ideas.
But yet it doesn't. If it really matters if they're getting a certificate or degree.
Yeah, we're trying to capture those students
still,
as well.
Still trying to capture the NI and pushing them beyond what they used to.
Yeah, we are, just through all the CORs that we have here that I have seen, you know, the challenge all the students regardless.
But I'm saying, I see that what happens is sometimes students come for skills and then they get exposed to all of the other things and they stay.
Just a matter of being in the classroom.
And yes, and then they may go further in their education, which, I mean, that's part of what we're supposed to be doing, right? I think, you know, just getting to that question of what is a community college as opposed to what is, you know, an R1 university.
I mean, I think regardless of the setting, you know, as a teacher, you know, not going to use the highfalutin word professor, as a teacher, you know, as somebody who interacts with human beings, I have to exercise nimbleness,
mm-hmm.
you know, nimbleness of thought, nimbleness of reading the room, nimbleness of how far I can push it at any given time, going in small increments, you know, and so on and so forth. So there's no inherent contradiction in my mind in serving all communities. But there is, again, a kind of EQ that needs to be exercised.
EQ, meaning emotional quotient?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, emotional intelligence. So they exercise, you know, and there's no contradiction with that and academic freedom, in my mind.
We don't know the term.
Yeah, I don't see a contradiction. I see and maybe I'm reading too much into your questions, but I see this. Going back to your point, Molly, I see some potential problems in how we answer the question, what is the purpose of higher education? What is it that academic freedom is serving? I think about, you know, colleagues that I've had, my wonderful colleagues, who believe that our purpose is to make better people. And I've had colleagues say that explicitly. And whenever I hear that, I always think, like, boy, there's a lot of assumptions built into that. One, that you know what a good person is. And two, that you are so thoroughly knowledgeable about what a good person is that you can actually make more of them. And that's when it starts to sort of slip off the rails a little bit for me. So I'm thinking about your comments about the diverse community that we serve. And kind of what I hear you saying is, I've got to be able to look out at this group of very diverse people, and I've got to figure out how to meet all of their needs. And I've got to do it in a way that it advances their learning in a particular subject. Which all makes sense.
Without alienating them.
Well, yeah, and without trying to co-opt who they are as people.
As people.
And to say, well, I'm going to use this classroom environment as a way of shaping their worldview so that it aligns more with what I think an appropriate worldview is. And that's where I think it starts to get dangerous.
My worldview is, it's the confines and the parameters of my chosen discipline.
No, I think you're right.
I want to be very careful with that distinction. You know,
yeah.
I leave my worldview at the...
Yeah, not applying.
For the most...
Well, no, I don't mean to apply
sure
that.
It comes through, but...
What I'm saying is, your perspective isn't necessarily as widely accepted as I think it needs to be. I do think that my mom gave me a birthday card years ago that I still have on my office wall, and it's a professor, and he's got his leg hiked up on his desk, and he's like dressed in his 19th century garb, and it says, I was meant to lead a revolution, not teach, right? And that, I think, is a pretty common sentiment.
It is a pretty common sentiment.
And that's what I think is the risk. I think what you're articulating, what you're describing,
is surround, read. This is silly fine. Weird. So I think we need to take a break and then we'll be back with our guests.
In this second, the session two.
Okay. Okay.
We'll be right back. tomorrow.